From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, political satirist Bill Maher lays down his new rules. Maher hosts the HBO series Real Time. He ends each program by reading his new rules, which are basically his top 10 of political and cultural criticism. His new rules are collected in a new book of the same name. Also, we talk about the fatwa, or religious ruling, condemning terrorism for violating the principles of Islam. We'll hear from Muzammil Siddiqui, chairman of the North America Islamic Council, an association of Islamic legal scholars that issued the edict on July 28th. More than 100 Muslim American organizations endorsed the fatwa. And Ken Tucker reviews recordings by the Fleshtones and the Adolescents. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Bill Maher, is a political satirist who doesn't pull his punches. That's what his fans love him for. And his detractors, well, let's just say that one congressman described one of Maher's bits as bordering on treason. We'll get to that controversy a little later. Maher is the host of Real Time, a weekly HBO series of political satire and debate. The new season starts Friday, August 19th. He ends each program with a segment he calls New Rules, which is basically his top 10 criticisms of politics and culture. His new book, New Rules, is a collection of his new rules. I asked Bill Maher to read a few from the book.
New Rule. Stop calling the media elite and liberal and start calling it what it really is, lazy. It came out recently that the Bush administration has been producing its own news segments, complete with their own correspondents, and sending them off to local news outlets who aired them untouched. No wonder Hunter Thompson blew his brains out. I'm sorry, but the local news is not the place for government propaganda. It's the place for car chases, kittens caught in trees, and a meteorologist whose previous job was at Hooters. New rule. Gay marriage won't lead to dog marriage. It's not a slippery slope to rampant interspecies coupling. When women got the right to vote, it didn't lead to hamsters voting. No court has extended the Equal Protection Clause to salmon. And for the record, all marriages are same-sex marriages. You get married, and every night, it's the same sex. New rule. Don't try to talk to me about desperate housewives. If I had the slightest interest in other people's sex lives, I'd be a Republican. New rule. When you buy a country, get a receipt. The CPA, the American agency that ran Iraq, can't account for $9 billion it spent there. If Clinton's people had lost $9 billion, he would have been impeached underwater while sharks gnawed his legs to stumps. Can we finally stop pretending that Republicans are fiscally responsible? At least when Saddam Hussein stole the taxpayers' money, he ended up with a nice palace to show for it.
That's Bill Maher reading from his new book, New Rules. Bill Maher, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Hey,
Terry. One of the things I love about new rules when you do them on your show is that, like, some of them are just so funny that people like your guests, conservative guests who completely disagree with you and completely disagree with the new rule that you're reading, they still just, like, break up.
That is the great thing about comedy, I have to say, is that because it is a completely involuntary response, it does bring people together. Because when someone laughs, somewhere inside of them says to them, there's some truth in that. We all know that if it wasn't true, we wouldn't have laughed in the first place.
Well, here's another thing that I see with a lot of some of your conservative guests who I know would oppose the kind of language that we hear on HBO, which is not censored for language.
Right.
When you use those words in your four rules, I see them, like, really laughing, but at the same time looking really uncomfortable about laughing, kind of confused about how to respond.
Yeah, politicians especially, people.
Yes,
who have
exactly.
Yeah, that's why I love a panel without a politician on it, or with a politician who's no longer running. There's no better guest than a someone who's left office recently. Because they kind of want to talk, and they don't have to answer to anybody anymore. And you can tell that they've got a lifetime of stories and feelings that have been built up inside, because unfortunately, in this country, for some reason, we want our candidates to be what looks to me like soulless automatons who are so righteous that they can't even laugh at something a little off color. And it's unfortunate that we don't want our politicians to be more human. But that's, I got to say, that's the fault of the voter. If the voter didn't feel that way, I don't think the politicians would act that way.
Do you think that some politicians, before coming on your show, hire a joke writer to help them come up with some laugh lines? And if so, is that a good thing or a bad thing? So on the one hand, they're more likely to get laughs. On the other hand, it's laughs that somebody else wrote for them.
I don't think they do that anymore. Maybe on my old show they did that. I certainly would strongly discourage that on this show. I always tell the guests, be yourself. So politicians don't think they ever come off well when they recite canned lines. Again, these are, like I was just saying, these are the kind of people we want for office for some reason, who are humorless. John Kerry, Al Gore, you know, these kind of people, Bush, they don't remind me of the Kennedy wit or Franklin Roosevelt, or even Ronald Reagan had a more natural sense of humor. Clinton had a pretty good sense of humor. He never really tried to make a joke. And when these guys try, you can just tell, oh, this is something that Al Franken faxed to you last night, and you tried to memorize it, and you mauled it in the delivery, and now we're all suffering. So why don't you shut up and get back to your policy wonkness?
Well, there's a congressman from Alabama, Spencer Backus, who didn't think something you said on your May 13th show was very funny. You were talking about how the Army missed its recruiting goal by 42% in April, and you said that more people had joined the Michael Jackson fan club. And then you said we've done picked all the low-lying Lindsey England fruit, and now we need warm bodies. He said, this congressman said, your comments bordered on treason. And he said, in treason, one definition is to undermine the effort or national security of our country. And he said, I don't want Mark prosecuted. I want him off the air. So how far did he get?
Well, obviously not very far. He shut up real quick when I... Well, I mean, it was really not worth answering, but I did because my friend Ariana Huffington said, Bill, why don't you do a blog for my blogosphere? So I blogged, and I wrote in the blog a few things that made him shut up rather quickly. Number one on that list was, excuse me, I'm a comedian. If we're talking about the troops here... I can't really affect the troops' lives, but you are a congressman. You could affect the troops' lives. Why don't you stop yelling at me, which is stupid and silly, and get to work in Congress getting them the armor they need, for example, or any other of 100 desperate needs that these men have that are not being met in Iraq. So I think that took care of him. And also I would like to say two other things. One, the term treason, boy, the bar on that one has really been lowered. I could easily also say right back to this congressman by suggesting that the troops are so fragile that the comments of a comedian all the way back in America could serve to lower their morale. That could be considered treasonous if that's where the bar is on treason. And also, Barry McCaffrey, who was our former drug czar and who was one of the lead generals in the first Gulf War, recently made a statement that was almost exactly what I said. He was talking about recruitment, and he said, we've reached the bottom of the barrel. Well, we've picked the low-lying fruit, we've reached the bottom of the barrel. I don't see much of a difference between those two comments. So if I'm a traitor, then I guess General Barry McCaffrey's a traitor, too.
Nevertheless, did you take that line about the low-lying fruit outside out of one of your new rules?
No, not at all.
Oh, it's still in there? Okay.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It was an editorial that we do at the end of the show every week, which starts out as a new rule. And then expands to something a little more serious. And the I can understand why this Republican congressman was probably sensitive about this issue or this editorial, because the point of the editorial was, now that we cannot reach our recruiting goals, maybe the people who wanted this war to begin with should be the ones who are first in line to volunteer and go fight for it. I think there was a line in there, something about, the Bush twins have been out of college for over a year, and they haven't been able to find work. What's holding them back? Do they hate America specifically or just freedom in general? So it was sort of a poke at the chicken hawks.
My guest is political satirist Bill Maher. His new book is called New Rules. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Bill Maher, and he has a new book called New Rules that collects his new rules from his broadcasts. And his HBO series begins again on Friday, August 19th. One of your goals during the last season of your show was to get more conservatives into your audience so that people couldn't accuse you of just having liberals in the audience, and so that you'd have people responding to both sides. So how successful was the experiment?
Not very. Not for lack of trying.
What did you do to try?
Well, I'm not in the audience department, so I personally didn't do a heck of a lot. I suppose I could have stood out on Venice Boulevard and handed out the tickets to anyone who was
I've seen people doing that in Times Square for some talk shows.
Oh, yes, they do it for lots of shows. But it would be hard to pick out who were the conservatives. I suppose I could have gone down to San Clemente and tried to find anyone walking on the beach in a blue suit like Richard Nixon used to do with wingtips. But no, we did everything we could. I announced it on the air over and over again. And I know that we instructed our crack staff in the audience department to cull as many people as we could. They were very resistant. We did achieve it for one show. There was one show where we had an absolutely balanced audience, and I loved it. I thought it was great. It kept everybody honest. And we tried to repeat it, and we're redoubling our efforts. We want to do it again this year. I just talked to Dennis Miller the other day, and I was telling him, hey, you know what? I want you to come on, and I know you probably have concerns like every other conservative that the audience is stacked against you, and I promise you we will do everything we can to achieve some sort of parity. And it's a problem. The conservatives, I think they have to look in the mirror, though. We're extending the hand. It's they who are not accepting.
Tell Dennis to bring some of his people.
Dennis doesn't have any people. Dennis is a lone wolf.
Well, you have in one of your new rules in the new book is about the division between blue state and red state and your impressions of your identity as a blue state person. Would you read an excerpt of this for us?
New rule: stop saying that blue state people are out of touch with the values and morals of the red states. I'm not out of touch with them. I just don't share them. In fact, and I know this is about 140 years late, but to the southern states, I would say, upon further consideration, you can go. I know that's what you always wanted, and we've reconsidered, so go ahead and take Texas with you. You know what they say, if at first you don't secede, try again, and give my regards to President Charlie Daniels. Oh, sorry, I almost forgot. We're trying to be in a time of healing. The time when blue states and red states come together because we have so much to offer each other. Spice rack, meat gun rack. Picky about bottled water? Say hello to drinks from a garden hose. Bought an antique nightstand at an estate sale? Meat uses a giant wooden spool he stole from the phone company as a coffee table. Sorry, there I go again, kidding when I should be healing. But sometimes I just don't understand this country. I don't get that your air is poison and your job is gone and your son is scattered all over a desert you can't find on a map, but what really matters is boys kissing. Say what you will about the Republicans, they do stand for something. Okay, it's Armageddon, but it's something. Democrats, on the other hand, have been coasting for years on Tom Daschle's charisma, but that's just not enough anymore.
That's Bill Maher reading one of his new rules from his new book, New Rules. Well, okay, Tom Daschle's charisma is not relevant anymore. He's out. What do you think of Harry Reid?
That was, I think that was the one we did right after the election. Mm-hmm. Harry Reid, well, I think that's emblematic of what's wrong with the Democratic Party. Not that I'm sure he's not a nice guy, but if the Democratic Party, the party that's supposed to represent me, I guess, or at least represents me more than the other party, and yet the face of that party is a guy who's pro-life and pro-gun lobby, this is my problem with the Democrats, is they keep trying to be more like the Republicans, and I want a party that represents me, and I don't feel I have that. John Kerry, yes, I voted for him because I wasn't certainly going to vote for the other guy, but does he represent me? Not very much. You can go down the list of issues, and rarely does his point of view mirror my own. And even worse, the issues that are most important to me, he didn't even bring up during the campaign. He didn't even bring up the environment, didn't bring up the drug war, didn't bring up the corporate stranglehold on this country. These are the issues that are important to me. And the person who was supposed to be my champion didn't reflect that. I don't think most Republicans would say they have the same problem. I think they feel like George Bush represents them a lot better, and he probably does.
Is there anyone in the House or Senate or in the leadership of the Democratic Party or any other party that you feel does reflect you?
Well, you can't tell until they get into office because if you told people what you thought, you'd never get elected. But there are two senators, Biden and John Edwards, who I like a lot. I think they're guys who are able to make the counter argument. It seems to me that the biggest Democratic problem is that they live in trembling fear of saying the right thing, because they imagine what it will come out as after it's been through the Republican slime machine. And that's why they don't really make the counter-argument. They're afraid of Karl Rove's brilliant traps, evil but brilliant. But I think guys like Biden and Edwards, these are guys who know how to play that game, as Clinton knew how to play that game. And we haven't had a guy like that since Bill Clinton. So... But do they represent my point of view? No. I would say people like the third-party guys like Ralph Nader and Ross Perot, what they were talking about, as I just mentioned, that stranglehold on this country from corporations, which is the definition of fascism, by the way, when corporations take over a government, that really is the right issue. I know none of us could get behind Ralph this time because it was a lost cause, but it doesn't mean that what he was saying was wrong or had become wrong. It was right then. It's right now. Ross Perot had it right about lobbyists. Lobbying is really the fourth branch of government now. People talk about Tom DeLay and say he's a terrible guy. Well, of course he is. And they say he's what's wrong with Congress. Yeah, but he is what Congress is. He's just representative of Congress, which is a place where if you don't pay for influence, you don't get heard. And that's certainly not the way this country was supposed to be.
You know, a lot of people are concerned that the best talk show guests are the ones who get voted into office because so much of the campaigning is done by being a good guest on interview shows. As the host of one of those shows, do you ever feel like you measure somebody's political ability by their performance on your show? I mean, does that affect your opinion of them as an elected leader?
Absolutely. But you're talking about my show where they're asked difficult questions and their feet are held to the fire, which is why a lot of them won't do my show. If you're asking me if I'm impressed or not by their appearance on The Letterman Show or The Daily Show or Leno Show or any other show where they're just asked to show their human side, that I don't care about. I don't care if a guy holds hands with his wife in the movies. I don't. That's not, you know, I care about what sort of a leader he's going to be and what his ideas are, not silly things that obviously are important to a lot of other people.
Are there any conservative or right-wing TV or radio shows that you feel like you have to pay attention to, that you watch or you know listen to?
I really don't. They're so predictable. You know, the people at Fox News, here's a new rule.
Yeah.
That I thought of the other day that I think we'll try to get into the new season. People at Fox News have to start referring to President Bush as my liege. They need to dress as a jester and just wear a powdered wig or something. If they're going to treat him like an infallible king, which is how they treat him, then they have to refer to him as my liege. That's my new rule.
On your HBO, your recent HBO special, which was a video version of the stand-up tour that you've been doing around the country, you said you don't hate your. You're often accused of hating America, and you said, "I don't hate my country. I'm just often embarrassed by its leadership." What embarrasses you about it?
Right. That's why the show is called I'm Swiss.
Yes.
And when the right wing hears me say I'm Swiss, that's when they say, oh, there you go, Bill Maher, hating America first. And I always say, I don't hate America first. I have my coffee. And then I hate America. And then I burn a flag, perform a few abortions, and I'm good for the day. No, I love America, as do most of my liberal friends. And yes, I am embarrassed by America. A good example, last week when President Bush once again said, jury is out on evolution. Things like that make me embarrassed to be an American, that it's the year 2005 and the leader of my country does not recognize evolution. This nonsense that these right-wingers keep putting forth, that somehow we're being more even-handed if we have creationism on the one hand, which they now have a code word for, because, you know, they wouldn't be Republicans if they didn't have a code word for something, intelligent design, and evolution. Okay, having two theories, one of which is nonsensical and stupid, and one of which is scientific, that's not being fair and balanced.
Bill Maher, we'll be back. This is Fresh Air.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, announcing Kids Count 2005, a state-by-state report on child well-being that looks at families overcoming barriers to work. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
Coming up, Bill Maher rewrites rap lyrics in standard English. Also, we talk about the July 28th fatwa condemning terrorism and religious extremism with the chairman of the Islamic Council that issued the edict. And Ken Tucker reviews silver anniversary albums by two 80s bands, the Fleshtones and the Adolescents. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with political satirist Bill Maher. His HBO series, Real Time, returns Friday, August 19th. He ends each edition with a segment he calls New Rules. He's collected his new rules in a new book of the same name. During the breaks between seasons of his HBO series, Maher does stand-up. His latest stand-up show, I'm Swiss, was taped for HBO, where it premiered at the end of last month. I have to ask you, one of the things you do in your HBO special, which is a video of your stand-up show, is you do standard English reinterpretations of rap lyrics, and it is so funny. How did you start doing that? And why don't you describe the whole concept, too?
Okay. I'm going to miss that. I mean, you say it's a video version of my stand-up act, which is true, but now that it's, once I do it as a special, I kind of retire that. So, when I do stand-up now, I'm putting together a new act, and I won't be able to do the rap lyrics anymore, and it's breaking my heart because it was always a favorite of mine and the audience. And what it is I wanted to get across the idea that when I was a kid, my father, as most fathers did, hated rock and roll. But if you printed out rock lyrics, because they are hard to hear, he would understand what the words were, and they wouldn't have been that threatening. About the most outrageous thing we ever heard was, "Come on, baby, light my fire." But that's not true with rap lyrics. First of all, you could print out the words, and by the way, you can find the words on the internet to most songs. But if you printed them out and showed them to a middle-aged white person, they would have no idea what the person is talking about because they're written in a language that middle-aged white people don't speak, which, of course, is Ebonics. But their kids speak it. Their kids know what the words mean. So the bit is that I translate lyrics from rap into white, and then I just read them. I read the literal translation. I don't read the rap version because, as I say, the folks wouldn't understand it to begin with. But when you just read the rap, when you read the white version, you can kind of get an idea of what the original version was, and therein hilarity ensues.
Would you do a couple of lines for us?
Oh, if I can remember them. I literally do read them. There's one song that I do from the Notorious B.I.G. with lyrics from R. Kelly. And the title of the song is I'm not going to say this word because it would have to be bleeped, but I'm blanking you tonight. And the translation is something like, "Tonight we won't be dining, we'll just be having intercourse."
It's one of my favorites.
Surely,
go ahead.
Surely you'll appreciate my stamina and the fact that I own a late model European sports sedan. If you shifted position, you would have a better view of our intercourse. I appreciate it when we have intercourse with increased vigor and velocity. Tonight we won't be dining, we'll just be having intercourse. And I promise you that those are faithful translations of the lyrics to that song.
Oh, that's so funny. You know, it reminds me a little bit. Do you remember Steve Allen back in the Steve Allen Show era?
My mentor.
He used to read the words to like doo-wop lyrics with a very straight face.
Yes. Oh, yes. Steve was one of my mentors, one of the people who really helped me when I started.
Oh, did he actually work? Yeah, really?
Oh, yes. When I was still working in the clubs in New York, he was doing a live show in off-Broadway called Seymour Glick is Alive But Sick, which was a bunch of silly songs that he had written that he had a few talented cast members singing and performing. And there was a role that he played on the off-Broadway version, which was the MC of the whole crazy show. And he wanted to do it on the West Coast, and he had me do his part at the Old Horn, which was one of the great old theaters out there. It's now a honey-baked ham, but it was a great theater at the time. And that was a great moment for me to be working with Steve Allen. I loved him. Another bit that he used to do, similar to the one that you just cited, he would read editorials out of the Daily News,
mm-hmm.
word for word, but he would just read it with the anger with which the editorial was written. And it was just hysterical. Oh, he was one of a kind, and never really got the due he deserved. I mean, he's still beloved, but I don't think the mainstream people, especially the young people, understand what a debt the people that they're watching today owe to Steve Allen. David Letterman, to his great credit, gives credit to Steve Allen, because a lot of the sensibility of the Letterman show, the man on the street, the stuff they do outside the studio, some of the crazy stunts they do, really owes its its pedigree to the Steve Allen days.
On the other hand, like later in his life, he became very culturally conservative and just kind of like the opposite of you when it comes to culture. And he would take out ads in the New York Times saying that, you know, television had become a sewer.
I remember.
Yeah,
I used to get letters from him where he would sort of carp at something that I had said or something that was on the show. Yeah, he did become, well, you know, he was from a different era where you needed absolutely no profanity to get laughs. And I think a lot of folks from his era, and there are folks who are still around, Mel Brooks, for example, was from that era, Neil Simon, Larry Gelbart, comedy writers who never had to resort to, you know, sexual innuendo jokes. And I think they feel like they watch a sitcom now at 8 o'clock at night and, you know, they're not 5 minutes into it and there's been three penis jokes. And I think they think that the folks today are cheating and that they're taking the culture down a peg. And they're not entirely wrong.
One more thing. In your show, you talk about how you smoke marijuana, and I'm thinking, why not just give a map to narcotics agents directly to your house and leave the door open?
Well, you know, I'm playing a character, Terry, on the show. The character Bill Maher smokes marijuana. I personally know. I have no idea what it's like. I have a scotch and soda, perhaps at 6:30 at night, one or two, and then I'm good for the week.
Bill Maher, a pleasure to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure, Terry. Thank you so much.
Bill Maher's new book is called New Rules. His HBO program, Real Time, returns Friday, August 19th. Coming up, the head of the Islamic Council that issued a recent fatwa condemning terrorism and religious extremism. This is Fresh Air. After last month's attacks in London, an American Islamic Council issued a fatwa condemning terrorism and religious extremism. A fatwa is a religious ruling based on the Quran. My guest, Dr. Muzammal Siddiqui, is the president of that council of 18 Islamic scholars, the Fiqh Council of North America. Dr. Siddiqui is also the director of the Islamic Society of Orange County, California, and the former president of the Islamic Society of North America. Would you summarize for us what the fatwa says?
This fatwa that was issued on July 28 was on the subject of terrorism based on the Islamic principles. And we mentioned that terrorism is against the teachings of Islam, so it is haram, it is forbidden to commit any acts of terrorism against the innocent people. It is also forbidden to cooperate with any individual or group who are involved in the acts of terrorism. And it is also the civic and religious duty of Muslims to cooperate with the law enforcement authorities to protect the lives of the innocent people.
Are there specific passages in the Quran that you would cite as the basics for this fatwa?
Yes. We have used the passage from the chapter number 5, verse 32, which says that killing any innocent person is like killing the whole humanity, and saving one life is like saving the whole humanity. So this is a very important statement that comes after the Quran related the story of Abel and Cain, the two sons of Adam, that one killed the other. After that says that, so that from the very beginning, God forbade the killing of the people, killing of the innocent people. And there are a number of other places in the Quran where it is forbidden to kill or to take the life unjustly.
What kind of teeth does a fatwa have? I mean, say you violate a fatwa, what does that mean?
Well, ours is a moral authority. We don't have any police. We don't have anything else. We only have a moral authority. So we tell the people what is right and what is wrong. And those who care for their religion, those who care about the issues of halal and haram, what is permissible and what is forbidden, they will certainly take it seriously. But again, like anybody else in any other religion, people listen, people don't listen. Even an authority like Pope John Paul made certain statements, and many Catholics did not listen to him. I mean, for example, the issue of abortion. Catholic tradition position is very clear on that, but some people don't follow that.
Does the fatwa that your council issued, and this is a council of North American Islamic leaders, does this fatwa extend to places outside of North America, such as, you know, Iraq or Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, any other countries?
Yes, we use this word civilians of any place, of any region. It includes that. It is Muslims, non-Muslims, everybody. So it is not limited to any one particular area. Wherever the civilians are, for us, terrorism means targeting the non-combatants, targeting the civilians for any reason, whether it is done by individuals, by groups, or states.
Does your fatwa extend to attacks against soldiers, such as American soldiers in Iraq or Israeli soldiers in the Middle East, or is the fatwa limited to attacks against civilians?
No, fatwa is limited only to civilians. But again, one has to discuss other issues, but we did not discuss that in the fatwa.
And how come?
Well, I mean, we are just discussing the civilian life. Civilian life is the one that we are talking about at the moment.
Okay.
Occupation and how to deal with the occupation, all those things, these are other issues that are broader issues. But under even in the Islamic law, even in the state of war, you are not supposed to kill the civilians. Even Palestinians, they are not allowed to go and blow up the cafes and the buses and where the common people are moving around, and they're not involved in the war, men, women, and children.
You were one of 15 Islamic leaders who met with President Bush in the White House after September 11th. And one of the things you did there was give him a copy of the Quran. What if anything, do you think came out of that meeting with the president?
I was very impressed with my meeting with the president, and I gave him a copy of the Quran. I said to him that you can read the copy of the Quran and you see that this Quran does not condone any of those acts that people have done. And I told the president, I heard that you read the Bible every day. I hope someday you will read also the Quran. And he said, I will. And he himself said that we should not use the word Islam for this thing. We don't call Timothy McVeigh Christian terrorist. This is what President said at that time. So we were very impressed. But unfortunately, after that, the media took a different turn and everything became Islamic, which is very unfortunate because it had nothing to do with Islam. Islam is this whatever these people or terrorists are doing, they are really violating Islam. So we should use some other term for that. Because when you use the word Islamic, you are unfortunately creating sympathy for them in the minds of many Muslims. For example, I'll give you an example. If somebody comes to my home to attack me or to steal, a robber comes, and I come out and say, a robber came, all my neighbors are going to have sympathy with me. But if I say a Christian came to attack me, people will not have that much sympathy. They may have changed, the whole thinking will change. So in a similar way, if you are using the terrorist came and terrorists did that, people will support you. But when you say Muslims came, Islamic people came, well, Muslims will have double mind. So you are changing that. So how to fight the terrorists? Not to generalize them, not to make them as part of the broader community, make them small.
Let me quote something that you said in 2000, and this is quoted a lot, like when you Google your name. You said this at a rally outside the White House, a rally protesting American support of Israel. And what you said was, America has to learn if you remain on the side of injustice, the wrath of God will come. But we want blessings for America, That's why we want the conscience of America to be awakened and the Americans to stand on the side of justice. I know people who were critical of what you said see it as a kind of veiled ultimatum, like if America continues to support Israel, the wrath of God will come. Of course, that's not what we want. We want America. We prefer America change its policy. But if it doesn't, the wrath of God will come. Is that an accurate interpretation? And how would you like us to interpret that statement?
It is a reminder. It was not a warning. It was not an invoking of the wrath of God, as some people have said. If I say to somebody, don't smoke because that will cause cancer, I'm not bringing a cancer on him. I'm not invoking cancer on that person. I'm just simply reminding that person, don't do that. So this is what I meant, that this is a reminder for our government and for everybody that we should remain always on the side of justice. Don't do injustice to anyone. And indeed, injustice brings the wrath of God. So we have to be very, very careful about that. I did not mean by justice that do injustice to Israeli people. I did not mean that. I did mean that do not let Israeli people do injustice to others, to Palestinian people. And the Palestinian people are suffering. So that in that sense, our government uses its power, its authority, its influence to see that there is fair game and there is equality, not one-sidedness. Be on the side of truth, be on the side of justice, not only on one side. Only that I meant, and I meant it in a very good spirit. And in that speech, I also said, you should read the whole speech. I said, we want that Muslims, Christians, and Jews live in peace in the Middle East. We want all people should live in peace in the Middle East.
Is it fair to say that you consider American support of Israel or Americans' policy in the Middle East to be sinful?
I want to see American foreign policy, American policy in the Middle East, more fair policy, more just policy. That policy, unfortunately, is not just, it's not fair, it's only one-sided. So I would like to see that become more fair. That doesn't mean that be against Jewish people, against the security of Israel. No. Israelis have a right to live in peace. Israelis have the right to live safe in that area. But Palestinians also have rights. They are also human beings. They are not animals. They also have rights. And their rights have to be recognized. That's what I meant.
One of the things that I think has been very confusing to a lot of people about the London attacks, at least the first set of bombings, is that the people behind the bombings were born in England. Mm-hmm. And they became very alienated from British society and Western society in general, so much so that they attacked the country that they were born in and lived in. What advice do you have for young Muslims whose own cultural values don't coincide with the larger values of the West when it comes to things relating from food to sex, to music and entertainment and politics. I mean, what advice do you have for them about how to live in a culture, even though your religion's values are different from the mainstream of that culture?
We have a whole subject called the jurisprudence for the minorities. And we speak about that. That is, when you are living in a country where you are a minority, you must respect the laws of the country. And there are certain matters in which you have to compromise. There are certain matters in which you adapt. Adapt yourself. So there are various levels. But we emphasize very much that the laws of the land must be respected. And we are here, especially in United States, we are very fortunate. I always emphasize that in United States there is no law that tells Muslims that they must do something that God said that they should not do. Although there are things that are allowed here in United States that Islam says are forbidden, but there is nothing that is obligatory upon us according to the U.S. law that Islam says that you must not do. So this is I always said this is a good thing for us, and we have to appreciate that.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Muzammal Siddiqui is the president of the Fiqh Council of North America, the group of Islamic scholars that issued a fatwa condemning terrorism and religious extremism. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews albums by two 80s bands, the Fleshtones and the Adolescents. This is Fresh Air. In the early 80s, the Fleshtones, founded in Queens, New York, and the Adolescents from across the country in L.A.'s Orange County, made rough, punk-influenced music. Neither band became huge stars, although the Fleshtones continued to tour in Europe. But both bands have just put out silver anniversary albums that rock critic Ken Tucker says still instructively demonstrate the opposite coast's approach to punk rock. Here's the first track of the Fleshtones album, a song called Bigger and Better.
On one level, the Fleshtones and the Adolescents aren't obviously comparable bands. In the early 80s, the Fleshtones specialized in a pounding but melodic garage rock that owed as much to the Trog's Wild Thing as to any song by a punk act. The Adolescents were Orange County malcontents 25 years before malcontents became lovable on the TV show The O.C. They made an intentionally messy combination of hardcore punk and politics. It's a stance they still take on their new album, O.C. Confidential, which you can bet is titled that to exploit the TV show, why not, but which is also loaded with statements about war and death that no TV show would touch. Both of these bands held the middle ground in their heyday. The Fleshtones remained in the shadow of the Ramones and Blondie. The Adolescents were never the media favorites that X or the Germs were. Both were solid, dependable, workaday outfits with loyal cult followings who filled a need. The Fleshtones provided party music that left dancers sweaty and grinning. The Adolescents, as their name suggests, were moodier and brattier and, surrounded by the Hollywood industry, more contemptuous and suspicious of the star-making process. Even, of course, as they lusted after it. The central problem of all L.A. punk. How can you avoid selling out in a company town? The Adolescents' answer has been to grow up a little. By contrast, the Fleshtones' new album goes out of its way to include a song about being serious about not being serious. Whoa.
You see it, hear it all the time. Flesh does a heat to remind you. It's sometimes best to leave it. People working hard all of their lives, trying to earn a nickel or dime. No time for relaxing. It's sometimes best to leave it. Let's get serious about not being serious,
serious
about nothing.
Let's get
serious about not being serious. Come on and give it a try. Let's try.
With a country separating them, the Adolescents and the Fleshtones released their debut albums in 1981. Neither got much more than admiring reviews in their hometowns. The Fleshtones featured better vocals and a sense of history, evincing the influence of rockabilly and garage rock as well as punk. The Adolescents were better at ranting. Like a lot of LA punk bands, their way of rebelling against the LA rock establishment, like the Eagles and Fleetwood Mac, was to scream over a few guitar chords. What's fascinating is that 25 years later, their music sounds just as undercooked, overheated, and go-for-broke urgent as it did when they were bold kids. They worked in a genre that was supposed to explode rock and roll forever and ended up being rock and rollers forever.
Ken Tucker is film critic for New York Magazine. He reviewed O.C. Confidential by the Adolescents and Beachhead by the Fleshtones. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Mike and Scott. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor Audio Courses, including Masterpieces of Western Music, Classics from the Baroque to the Modern. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/fresh air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In 1971, a group of Vietnam veterans who opposed the war held a press conference describing atrocities they had seen or committed. The documentary about that event, Winter Soldier, was shown to few audiences in its time, but it will open theatrically this Friday. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with one of the vets in the film. Join us for the next Fresh Air.